time now for KSCO Presents Dr. and Mrs. Future.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO Presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks. Welcome to Future Tuesday. And it's sunny today. It's so beautiful. I did a time lapse from our deck up in Boulder Creek, watching the fogs melt away. And it's just beautiful. And maybe we'll put it on our website. What do you think?
Absolutely.
I got it up totally on my Facebook page. So we get some sunny weather for a while, folks. It should be fun to dry out and enjoy the outdoors a little bit more. So we have Mrs. Future on the microphone, and we have my brother Norm visiting in the studio, hanging out in the background.
He's waving.
Yeah, he's not one to talk much, but he listens well. He does talk well, too, when he does talk. So maybe we're lucky we might hear from him. We also have a couple of guests coming on the line. We have Dr. Bruce Damer. We're going to catch up with him, an indie scientist in the area who was involved with the asteroid capture and origin of life research. And now he's into a big project involving climate mitigation. So we'll be finding out about that about 2:30. And at 3 o'clock, we have Dr. Carl Merritt coming on. Now, last week, you might remember, I had a pretty spirited conversation with our station engineers and the populace on the whole issue of 5G and electromagnetics and health and RF and the dangers of RF. And, well, Carl's an interesting local physician because he's both an MD and an electrical engineer and will give us a little bit more insight into the whole 5G controversy, and I think even more importantly, his expertise in electromagnetics and health and what electromagnetic frequencies and such actually seem to improve our health.
Mm. And while we were speaking with our engineers last week, Carl was speaking at the Commonwealth Club with our prior week's guest, Camilla Reese, and they were addressing issues of 5G up in San Francisco.
Yeah, and Carl has done work in the area of Wi-Fi before this in some of the local schools and looking at how, what is it, about 3% of the population seem to be sensitive to Wi-Fi. So at 3 o'clock, we'll be talking more about that. Meanwhile, we're going to do a little bit of our news, and also we were at TEDx Santa Cruz this last weekend.
That's right. Everybody's been hearing the buildup of TEDx here on KSCO, and it was everything it was billed to be. It was a very inspiring day about the art of hope, and it started out with one of my favorite astrophysicists, Dr. David Deamer.
Ah, yes.
And he gave a wonderful current update on the latest theories of the origin of life. And he really taught us a lot about how scientists are reinventing their theories about the origin of life. And it comes down to whether life started in a salty ocean water or whether it started in fresh and soapy pond water.
A warm pond, yes, where life all began near a volcano somewhere.
That's right.
But the other interesting thing that Dr. Deamer is exploring is that it might have been a warm pond by a volcano, but possibly on Mars.
That's right. He brought his conversation all the way to thinking that it's just possible that the scum pond water on Earth was contaminated by a previous life form that had evolved on Mars, because Mars became a perfect Goldilocks habitable zone before
many
Earth.
Many years. Yeah, Mars was like Earth years before Earth, like billions of years before. And Earth, as a matter of fact, was a molten mess when Mars was like Earth. So the idea is that something from Mars came to Earth from Mars, and then it continued. And we'll find out whether or not this could be true next year with the 2020 lander that we're sending to Mars. And it's going to be specifically looking for evidence of life on Mars. And if we find any evidence at all, even a fossilized skeleton will work, we'll know whether or not...
A fossilized skeleton of some
of something
plankton.
Something on Mars. Or a fossilized skeleton of a bacteria.
Not of a full-blown alien.
We don't need much. We just need even a bacteria, a virus even. Mm-hmm. Give me something that's biological.
Right.
And we'll be able to tell a lot about it and whether or not we're related.
My favorite
and if
thing
so, how?
That he introduced that I had never seen before was a picture of Mars when it was a habitable zone. You may have seen pictures of Venus put next to Earth when Venus was a habitable zone.
Yes, what if Venus was
and
habitable?
It looks like our little twin blue marble planet.
It does.
Well, this was the first time I've ever seen Mars depicted as a twin blue marble planet. It was pretty cool.
Well, you know, that was one of Arthur C. Clarke's favorite projects after he retired in his senior years in Sri Lanka. Where he lived, he would take some of the earliest computers that we had that could do graphics, and he would try to create Mars as if it were habited, you know, or it was green, you know, and looking at each valley and seeing what it would take to make that valley habitable.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Let's see. You also had another favorite that you were mentioning from the TED Talks, a city worker who had a great story to tell about
Tim Goncharoff. Tim Goncharoff, Zero Waste Programs Manager for Santa Cruz County. And he's an innovator in government. That seems like an interesting combination. I'm glad that actually is happening. And he claims that our government is actually very open to innovation and in trying new ideas.
Meaning our Santa Cruz City and County government. They not only will embrace new ideas, they might be the first people in the country to embrace new ideas, and then they stick by them as the laws change and get big corporations to change their policies about handling environmental waste.
I think you gave an example, Coldstone Creamery. A lot of the creameries and ice cream vendors were using styrofoam cups at one point.
And Santa Cruz passed a law that said more waste that isn't fully recyclable, so no more styrofoam.
Right. So Cold Stone couldn't change right away because their corporate headquarters somewhere out in Midwest, I think it was Michigan, said, you know, we can't just change the rules for one store in a network of thousands.
Right. We've got our name printed on packaging all over the country. We're not going to stop putting it on styrofoam just because Santa Cruz changed the law.
So Tim tells them, well, you know, it'll be illegal in Santa Cruz and you'll get fined from our government if you want to continue doing this. And they said, okay, I'll always talk to corporate, you know. And they went back and forth several times on this issue until corporate called in with the news that they were going to change all of them. All the stores would
they
not
were gonna go,
be using styrofoam cups anymore.
That's right. And make all of their packaging recyclable.
Yeah.
And that was just the first of many examples.
I think Starbucks was one that changed also. And it started here in Santa Cruz where it was a nationwide change in the behavior and the use of like straws, I think was another one.
Right. And the point that he made is that the world looks to America for innovation in environmental leadership. America looks to California and California looks to Santa Cruz. So it was a really good talk to encourage people in Santa Cruz to continue thinking up ways to save the world and try it here.
This is an innovation center and we're proud of it.
That's
and
right.
What we think matters on a global scale.
That's right.
For real. All right, we'll see you after the break. We've got some more stories to share with you. Welcome back to the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show. So TEDx was great. I thought it was really worthwhile. They're going to be putting up a lot of the stories online at the TEDx Santa Cruz website, which is connected to our links page at drfutureshow.com/links. Now, in other future news, I thought it was very interesting that Virgin Galactic is available on the New York Stock Exchange.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
Can buy shares in space exploration for the first time.
Yes. They're one of the first companies out of the gate to offer you rides to space and back.
Right. Yeah, we've been tracking their progress since the millennium, the turn of the century, when there was the International Space Development Conference.
'04, I think, was when they won the X Prize.
They won the X Prize, and at the Orbit Awards, Burt Rutan became honored for being the first guy to successfully fly in a plane that got above the atmosphere and into space and then return to the ground and then do it again. So it was the first reusable spacecraft.
I call it the shuttlecock, a rocket, because it looks like a little shuttlecock. They take it up in an airplane, then its engine launches at like 50,000 feet, and it goes up into space, and you have a five-minute ride in zero gravity and what amounts to the head of a big shuttlecock. And then after 5 minutes, you come back down to where you started.
Right. Right. Well, I think nevertheless, look at this. Less than 20 years ago, that was the state of the art.
Yeah, it was. It's a great first start. So, and they teamed up with Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic, and now apparently with Boeing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be offering the rides in a couple months.
That's right. And it's not just space tourism, although for the time being, that is their revenue model, is $250,000 seats on an airplane that goes into space then comes back again.
So, but what's interesting to me is that the reason why Wall Street likes them right now is because it's not just because of the space industry that they represent.
Or the billionaires that are taking rides.
But it's also because of some technology that they have the patents on,
mm-hmm.
as technology that involves hypersonic flight and to be able to have faster airplanes that go between cities for commercial routes. See, that's where the real money is.
That's right. And so they were saying that in 5 to 10 years, they will actually be a player in disrupting the airline industry because
of this technology.
The carbon footprint of a rocket or a supersonic device that can go into space, hypersonic, can go into space and then speed to another location on the planet and land, that is a much lower carbon footprint than the current airline industry
it's a win in that department.
Use
too.
Gasoline and fight through the atmosphere for the whole trip.
Never mind that you're traveling anywhere on the planet in a few hours.
Right. Yeah.
Never mind that.
Right. It takes a 14-hour trip and makes it in 90 minutes or something.
Yeah, now also figuring how to get the cost down, of course, and carrying lots of people in them, a lot of things to figure out. But nonetheless, if you have the technology for actually creating this, then all these are mere details.
That's right. So faster, cheaper, better in the future.
So Virgin Galactic, keep an eye on them. I think they were like $8.20 for the price on Monday.
And he's talking about how much this stock costs.
And it's gone up 21%.
Yeah, it's like $8.90 now.
Oh, you've been checking, have you?
I checked just before the show.
Yeah, we
it's going up.
Yeah, we decided to try a little bet on this.
Yeah, well, we like the idea that we can have a little investment in the future of space
development. We like having lots of little piddly amounts in our favorite companies.
Yeah, right. That's our...
See if it works.
Our nest egg.
So we're keeping it... Yeah, our nest egg.
In space.
But still, it's an area we like. Maybe it's foolish, but I like putting a little behind the stuff we really like.
Absolutely.
You know, resources and
absolutely.
See what happens.
Yeah.
In that realm, I'd say our biggest success so far has probably been Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Though they've not been doing so well lately, now that they've got more competition from Disney and Apple and HBO. And
they reinvented Hollywood. They reinvented how we all see movies. And they're a player.
Yeah, now they're a studio. Now it's a matter of ideas and who gets the best movies.
Mm-hmm.
More than the infrastructure at this point.
Right. But they have a lot of dedicated monthly subscribers, and that's their business model, and we love them.
There have been many stories about this, about a DNA test that showed that somebody was not who everyone thought it was.
This story from the top. Okay. This is such a weird one.
This is a DNA test. You might have seen this in the news here, but it's a DNA test that says that you're somebody that's younger and you live 5,000 miles away. What do you do?
Well, don't trust your DNA, obviously.
Yeah. But apparently, a man with leukemia found that his donor's DNA traveled to unexpected parts of his body.
Right. Okay. Somebody who lived 5,000 miles away had DNA that traveled. It was a bone marrow transplant.
Bone marrow transplant.
That's where the DNA came from.
That's right. And he basically got a transplant. It was a life-saving procedure. It's pretty important.
And why did they do bone marrow transplants?
For cancer.
Because they think that weak blood will be replaced by strong blood from the new bone marrow.
Right. Right. So by doing so, we knew that it changes the DNA in your blood. Your blood becomes the DNA of your donor. Mm-hmm. But what they found is that it wasn't just his blood that was changing. They started finding the donor's DNA in his organs.
Yeah, well, I mean, it shouldn't be that surprising. The blood that the bone marrow generates has to go somewhere, right?
Well, it starts spreading through your entire system.
That's right. It's a one big unified body after all.
So it makes you wonder. So the doctors, they've been asked questions like, well, does this affect your brain and your personality then if you start having a different DNA?
Uh-oh. You know what he really was surprised by?
What?
All of the DNA in his semen belonged to the donor.
Really?
I'm reading it right here.
Okay. That's the New York Times one. Watch this news here. Okay, yes. It does seem to be the semen, yeah. Mm-hmm. And according to Andrew Rezvani at the Stanford University Blood and Marrow Transplant Unit, he says that your brain and your personality should remain the same.
Hypothetically.
Should.
Well, doctor, will I be able to play the violin after this operation? You know that old joke?
No,
sure.
I don't.
Well, great, because I don't know how to play it now.
Right. Okay. Thanks for reminding me. The doctor also added that patients also ask him what it means for a man to have a woman's chromosomes in their bloodstream or vice versa. And
yeah.
He says, that doesn't matter either.
Really? To who?
Same question. Same joke. Say it again. But for a forensic scientist, it's a different story. Because criminal investigators gather DNA for evidence, right? For crimes. And they're looking for the perpetrator. And that code... Not two codes is what's important to them. So, in other words, if a person has a different DNA than they used to have, does that make them less discoverable as the culprit?
Well, that is the point of this article.
Right.
This article is that the big news here is that this Kimera person, this mutant that now has DNA from...
Two people...
can be mistaken for the wrong person if there's ever a crime committed. That was the big news here.
Right, right. So it affects the whole criminal justice system and the way that we do DNA testing. Mm-hmm. But just have to get more sophisticated.
Right.
You know, people who have multiple DNAs will probably be more normal in the future. Anyway,
right.
As we start to play more with DNA, it seems like.
Yeah. Well, let's see, what does it say? The Washoe County Sheriff's Department has been using their colleague, this person who has this DNA mutation, as a guinea pig to understand what happens, even though they know that it's very unlikely in the future that they'll be chasing criminals who have this quality.
Yeah, you just see if they had a bone marrow transplant. You know, a little more research, not that much more, but a little bit more for the
detective. Well, I imagine that people who donate their bone marrow maybe will need to register in case they come up in these searches. It's not me. It's my bone marrow.
Yeah. Right? Well, initially, yeah, I think. But if it gets more common, that's when it gets more interesting to try to figure out.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, time for our next break.
All right. With any luck, we have Dr. Damer on the line. We'll be back to you after the break.
Dr. Future Show. We'll be right back.
Trees went back,
Welcome back to the show. Looks like we have Dr. Bruce on the line. Dr. Bruce Damer.
How are you doing?
Bruce, welcome to the show. Our indie scientist at large back on the line. Great. Bruce, I'd like to talk to you about your projects on climate mitigation, but first, we have a caller on the line who was triggered by a comment we made about the latest ideas from Dr. Damer, your partner. And
yes.
Perhaps we could handle our caller talking to him first before we delve into the climate issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Okay. So let's bring on our caller, Mrs. Future.
Well, hello, caller Pure Heart. You wanted to talk about life on Mars?
Oh, thank you. You're very kind. First, you mentioned the Virgin Galactic ship. If it's the Virgin Galactic Boeing MAT spaceship, I guess you wouldn't go on that one. But you guys might remember, Dr. Future probably remembers, but your child bride would not, the Viking landers back in the 70s.
Yes, yes.
And the principal investigators of the so-called chicken soup experiment, trying to find life on Mars, they were confirmed, they were sure they had found it. And then when NASA came along and said, no, just a chemical reaction. And a couple years back, when the guys were retiring, the principal said, we still think we discovered life on Mars. And they never backed down from it.
Yeah. I've read about that. Bruce, do you know anything about that?
Okay, that's all I had. So just thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Thank you. The original origin of life research on Mars back on the Viking lander.
Yeah, it's a tricky one because what they're looking for is called biosignatures. And in the case of Viking, the only thing that they could do is test the soil. They could image it. They could do chemical analysis. So they could make a guess. And So, for instance, recently, methane has been detected sort of in blooms coming out of the Mars surface. But nobody knows if that's produced by methanogen life underneath or
by rocks,
geochemistry. So there's an international effort, and I'm part of that, a small part of that, to go to Mars and bring rocks back to Earth from localities that might contain evidence where we can really see it. We could see microfossils or stromatolites or chemical evidence that's much more definitive. And so there are efforts around the world now to do that very difficult mission.
That's the 2020. Now, your colleague, Dr. Damer, was talking about looking for evidence of life on Mars, be it a skeleton or alive or even a fossil. Would this 2020 lander be able to detect that kind of information?
What Mars 2020 is doing, it's landing in a lake delta, an old river going into a lake, and it's going to where the water was, which is where Curiosity also landed, in a lake bed, finding mudstone. So that's all very, very suggestive. It's going to create samples, a cache of samples that would be picked up by a later mission that's still, it's not funded, it's just being talked about. So that's a long time off. Other countries are involved in doing sort of pick-and-place, more sort of rapid missions, a simpler mission that can go and grab a few rocks and then get them back in a capsule and get them on an Earth return trajectory.
Right, like we're trying to do with the moon, but it has been done.
It has been done, yeah.
Yeah, and the asteroids too, right, getting samples.
Yeah, there are two missions doing that right now.
So. That's right, you're involved with one of those too, aren't you?
I was involved in meetings in Japan last year, and it's been very successful, that whole direction. We're kind of in a golden age of this kind of exploration.
Seeing what's in the asteroids. And
the gold rush to the asteroid belt.
The gold rush.
Okay, we'll get to one of the intriguing things that Dr. Damer talked about was that if we find evidence of life on Mars, then we should be able to sequence it and see if we're related to it.
Yeah, and he, of course, is one of the inventors of the nanopore sequencing technology that he held the device up at the TEDx Santa Cruz on Saturday.
Oh, yeah, that was cool.
Wasn't that cool?
What does that device do exactly?
It sequences RNA and DNA. So it's a handheld device that connects to a laptop, and it's a revolution in gene sequencing.
It's like a $1,000 sequencer. Instead of just paying for your genome sequence, you can start sequencing it yourself.
Yeah. There's quite a few complex chemical steps you have to do before you feed the machine. But
yeah, so it's not trivial to use it then.
It looked like a harmonica. I was imagining that it would take the DNA code, the four notes, and just play it like a song.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful image, Mrs. Future.
With the right AI, Mrs. Future.
Yeah, it would be a very long song because, there's so many billions of genes.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Dave, some years ago, actually did set the notes for ACTG to music and played it out.
Yeah, I've heard of stories along these lines in the early days of the internet. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what kind of tunes actually come out of people. Mm-hmm. Especially these hybrids we've been talking about, the shamaric, where people have the DNA of more than one person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Are there harmonic chords or not?
Yeah. Okay, so Bruce, we talked about Diemer, and he was involved in the Origin of Life, and you've worked with him on projects along these lines, and asteroid capture. And now you're talking about climate mitigation. Can you tell me, help us see how you've gone from those two worlds to climate mitigation as your next focus?
Thanks to our good friend Baron, I went on a trip to Qatar last January. Mm-hmm. And there, during meetings, I happened to meet Admiral Norman Hayes of the U.S. Navy, retired. And we got along well. And we walked around Qatar and realized the whole place was going to be underwater and rusting within a generation or two.
That bad, huh? Wow.
And it's one of the world's richest countries. So we figured they're going to wake up and realize they need drainage and seawalls and living seawalls, and they need to re-engineer their small country, and they're going to do what we'd call climate mitigation, and it'll be $100 billion of work.
Well, can you give us an example of what kind of work is that? That's a lot of money.
It's like turning them into Amsterdam?
Yeah, they're going to have to do things like the Dutch did, and they'll build sort of living seawall polder systems that can last 1,000 years instead of just concrete, which is not, you know, we may have 500 to 1,000 years of this, or it may be indefinite. So why not build a seawall where there's agriculture in between two dikes, and then create a whole new ecosystem in the country, which is a desert country?
Sure. Start emulating nature in the way that you mitigate climate.
So it brings more agricultural capacity to them, this system you're talking about?
It's like mega engineering. We're going to have to do it as a civilization to bridge over the shocks that are coming. And so
these are big projects.
Big projects. So what Norman and I cooked up over the spring in numerous calls was we need to create a for-profit network of companies called Climate Mitigation Associates. And then what came up also was a nonprofit international design challenge called Climate Moonshots.
So this is the kind of the
what are the guiding principles?
The experimental projects to see what
So, for example, if Qatar in 2-3 years decides, hey, we need to solve this problem, why don't we have an international competition? Engineering firms always have these competitions anyway for big projects. Mm-hmm. Why don't we have it on a global scale and say one of them is build for rising sea levels and create a competition and offer a $10 million prize for this particular moonshot? And all these companies would appear, venture capital, large firms, designs would be put forward.
I have an idea.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
I think we should devote the bottom floor of all new buildings to be docks for boats.
Right.
Well, they're the right environments.
And then you step off your dock and you get into your elevator and go up to the building above.
For Venice, that may be the requirement at this point, although most of the buildings do have docks.
Yes, they're already halfway there.
Well, I was inspired by Venice in that idea, for
maybe
sure.
Maybe the ones, you know, maybe it's also, if they could expand Venice, maybe if they get good at floating cities, they could just add that as a new neighborhood, where they're already waterlogged city. So where water is incorporated as part of the ecosystem, offshore dwellings.
And so instead of just being in a panic about these things, our species was evolved by climate change.
Yes.
We were thrown out of the jungle into dried East Africa, and then we moved into Asia with glaciers, and we're creatures that evolved by rapid climate shocks.
Yeah, like, and what else is new, right?
So we are pre-adapted to deal with this thing on a global scale, but not if we're fighting each other and being anxious, and we need to just get down to work.
Okay, so you're saying we should all just calm down and realize that rapid adaptation is human nature.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, and we're good at it. But we have to work together, and we have to release trillions of dollars of finance that's not doing anything right now, and go work with cities, work with governments, work with the military. Like, we are working with military people who are good planners and good leaders.
So tell us about Norm Hayes, your partner.
Norm Hayes is amazing. He's the first African-American head of the Office of Naval Intelligence during the Afghan operation, during the whole theater of war. And and he and I got together, and we just really jived. We both like forward planning. So we cooked this thing up. And I've been working off and on with Pentagon people for 20 years who got more and more alerted to the global security risks from climate change. And so the Pentagon's now on a footing of caring about this and doing studies and reports and starting to take action.
And the intelligence community as well, right?
Yeah, but mostly it's coming from the DOD and especially the Navy, because the Navy's facilities will be impacted. But they realize that wars often start because of food shortages, because of climate change. Like the Syrian crisis was started by a drought period. And it got tangled up in politics, and then it became a serious military conflict.
All right. Well, we're about to go to a break, and let's have some more thoughts on how to successfully navigate the future of climate.
Yeah, what are the dangers of this, and what about geoengineering? Let's talk about more about this after the break.
Sure, yeah.
All right, see you in a minute. Talking to Dr. Bruce Damer about climate mitigation, big projects that are underway, and thought you'd like to know.
Humanity is still going to be here in the future.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer on climate mitigation. We got a text from George of Pleasure Point, who asks you, Bruce, why mitigate climate? Why not just surf it?
Well, in
what do you mean by mitigation, I guess?
Mitigation is, like, for instance, if sea levels rise, we lose 70% of the world's airports. So we can't necessarily just surf that. we have to build up runway.
Well, that's why Sir Richard Branson is getting ready to replace airplanes with spaceships.
Right. So
protect our assets.
We have to protect
our
assets.
That's why Elon Musk is catching his rockets on big floats in the ocean.
Recycling.
Yeah. But of course, those facilities that float up, those barges are going to be in trouble.
Right.
So you'll have to mitigate as well.
Space industry will have to adapt.
Everyone will have to adapt.
Not so close to the coast or water-based rockets.
Yeah, and agriculture. We're going to have hurricane-type storms coming up California in 15, 20 years. Mm. And we have to get ready for those, too.
Mm. Hurricane wind generators.
Yeah, we're going to
hurricane.
Yeah.
And it's going to change our agriculture tremendously to have these summer storms.
I was actually really impressed by one of the TED Talks that addressed a new concept in agriculture that was very much about a self-contained microclimate with appropriate solar power and a self-contained humidity system so that water could be recycled in areas that were basically impervious to weather mutation.
Right. This is called the solutionist movement.
Yeah.
Like a think tank that would be solutions oriented for climate mitigation issues as the initial step.
What our team came up with is that climate moonshots would be the 10 global challenges, design challenges, and sort of focus people on here are the 10 types of things we have to be doing. And then the commercial side, which would be thousands of companies actually, companies, government agencies, whatever, would be the builders, because there's going to be tremendous demand in 10, 15 years for all these mitigation solutions.
It'll take 10 or 15 years for the market to be viable for commercial use?
I'd say some countries like Qatar, 3 or 4, they're going to be contracting.
Because they're more on the edge now.
So yeah, places that are already seeing their country sink are a little bit more motivated to move.
Yeah, and then variously, the whole financial system of the world will shift over to this footing, really.
Will it take some kind of big disaster to get things moving on this, or is it already happening?
It's already happening. There's already concern. The oil companies that have their refinery complexes at sea level are getting salt into the equipment, and so they need to do something. Google and Facebook, they have their campuses directly on the bay. at no elevation, they're concerned. What is the long-term plan for them?
Floating buildings?
No, how about something...
Underwater buildings.
Anticipating life on other planets, they'll just put a dome over their facilities that is waterproof. And then the water can just go up over the dome and they can function underneath it.
Well, if they cared about all of us, they'd do something about the rising waters and keep it from rising somehow,
yeah,
right?
And truthfully, we need rapid carbon drawdown or sequestration. We have to start that now. And is that a trillion trees? Is that marshlands? It's probably not industrial equipment. Mm. But we actually have to start drawing it down so that the damage and the cost is reduced in 50, 60 years.
Well, let's see. Drones could plant, they say, a billion trees a year if we had the motivation.
Yeah, and people. People are very effective at planting on the ground, and this is our efforts already started. There's a company right here in Boulder Creek, actually, that just got funded to do this.
To plant trees?
To basically scan tree planting operations from space and determine which ones are sequestering carbon.
Uh-huh. All right. Yeah, we're going to reverse what's going on in the Brazilian rainforest and reward people who are actually adding trees and air to the planet and maybe identify people who are subtracting it.
What about taking CO2 directly out of the atmosphere? You know, machines that do that.
Well, plants are the machines
that do
that.
Well, they are. I mean, that's the bio solution. But I've heard, I think it was a Canadian company that was able to scrub the CO2 right out of the atmosphere. They had figured out a industrial-sized way of doing that.
Yeah, and you were mentioning before the break about geoengineering.
Yes.
I read a wonderful piece by Steven Pinker in one of his later books. And if you do geoengineering, say you put something in the atmosphere that reflects sunlight, the challenge you've got is if you do that kind of thing, it's a temporary thing. If you ran out of budget or the ability to keep that shield up and dropped it, the consequences would be swift and not pleasant.
Well, what do you say?
It's not a long-term.
I see. So it has to be sustainable for a long term. So if we created some kind of like giant sunglasses for the atmosphere, it would have to be maintained over time. Otherwise, it could fail and cause more problems than it's worth.
Yeah. If it goes down, then we're really in trouble. So in a sense, we have to really be practical.
So what would be a practical idea in your mind?
Well, it's a whole series of them.
Now, the biggest practical, on a geo scale, because a lot of these ideas are kind of crackpot that are geoengineering.
Right, yeah.
And how do you separate them? How do you know?
Well, there are people who are more pragmatists that can instantly sort of winnow those out.
I see.
Because if you're going to spend $10 billion, $100 billion, or $1 trillion, you're going to get the ones that are going to work for you. So there's a lot of pragmatic, despite what we see in our politics, there's a lot of pragmatic people in the world still.
And so the kind of organizations you are looking for are government, or are they private?
And amalgam of both.
Where do you look?
It's sort of an amalgam, and our friend Bonnie DeVarco, who is on the board of our nonprofit for decades, has been involved with Buckminster Fuller Institute, and they had the BFI challenges for 10 years. So that's a nonprofit, and that generated a huge amount of good things in the world, good projects and visibility. Yeah. So we're taking off on that.
That's the world game. The
Spaceship world game. Earth.
Yeah, and then you involve large corporations, small innovative companies, local groups, governments, cities. The military is really good because of their ability to do large-scale executions and their credibility. And then big finance. You need really big finance. And good storytellers, people who have a positive message. People really want a positive message. They want to have hope.
Yeah.
Have you seen any portrayals of what this kind of collaboration would look like in media at all? Is there any movies or anything that come to mind?
It's really just beginning. 2019 is the year. 2019 is the year of waking up. Mm. We had Greta Thunberg. We had all this stuff. But a lot of it's anxiety-based and sort of blame-based. And that's unsustainable, right? People can't go on for that. That doesn't really, but it did wake people up. And so now there are all these projects. There's Google X, there's the Schmidt Futures Institute. There's so many things in the Bay Area. We've been going to meeting after meeting this fall, all on this subject, and there's venture capital has woken up to it.
Innovators like to promote
everywhere.
Pachamama Alliance, too, because they have partnered with Paul Hawkins, who is the author of the book Drawdown Solutions, and they have all of these pre-internet-based citizen awareness groups educating people on different kinds of drawdown solutions that they can implement in their own homes and neighborhoods.
Yeah, we went up to Bioneers and we met Bill McKibben, and we hung around with that whole world there. And there's certainly no shortage of really good-hearted, good-minded people.
Yeah.
What do you say is needed next in this? Funding for a lot of people?
Yeah, we have to create bridges between funding and execution and large projects and local projects. We have to create a network, like a mycelial network that's intelligent, that can really get everybody working together. This is a global thing. We can't do it in isolation.
Right.
Is there a website where our listeners can look at the 10 types of things we need to do?
Yeah, we're building it this week. It's climatemoonshots.org with a plural. climatemoonshots.org is, and it's really just a placeholder. We're starting our fundraising campaign, so the one thing there is a PayPal donate button. Everything counts. It's a nonprofit, but the team is literally, the volunteer team is building out the site and the deck this week.
This is really the week it all starts to come together.
Wow. Yep.
All right.
All right. And creating living examples of sustainable structures that work for the future, right?
Yeah, so that we have a civilization in 50, 60, 70 years.
There's some new companies we were just reporting on about who are using balloons for photographing the atmosphere and the environment and the Earth itself. Perhaps some of these companies might be a good part of this mycelial network.
Yeah, there's a big table. Everyone's invited. Yeah.
All right. One more time with your website here before we're in the last minute here, Bruce.
So climatemoonshots.org, or if you want to reach me, it's damer.com, damer.com. And I have a Patreon. You can join, and we have conversations every week.
And we can get that at damer.com.
Yeah, and Bruce Damer at patreon.com.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, Bruce. Appreciate the update. And we'll be in touch, and so will our listeners.
All right, let's get working together on climate mitigation.
Yes,
right on.
Good seeing you at TEDx.
Good to see you guys.
KSCO Santa Cruz, Dr. Future Show.
Bye for now.